Last time we discussed the Dukey-Vonnegut method of estimating Fourier coefficients of a general Dirichlet series that has some nice properties with respect to twisting. So last time we discussed the Dukey-Vonnegut method of estimating coefficients of a Dirichlet series A of S equals summation n going from 1 to infinity A sub n n to the minus S. We want to estimate these coefficients given some information, given that A of S together with its twists, with its Dirichlet twists, A S chi, A N chi N over N to the S, satisfying suitable functional equations. Satisfying the condition that they extend to entire functions. And satisfy suitable functional equations. The precise nature of suitability is referred back to the notes of this lecture so that you can understand what they are. Suitable functional equations. So, this is a very powerful method. And a variation of this method has been proposed by Lou Orudnik and Sarnak, and it involves averaging of L functions. So let me explain this in more detail now. So here's the idea. We want to attack the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture to attack the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. So what does this say? This says that if I have a MOS form phi with a corresponding eigenvalue lambda, which we write as 1/4 plus r squared, which we know is a real number, so r is either real, or purely imaginary. And the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture says that the second possibility can't hold. So Selberg's conjecture. Is equivalent to the state, the assertion that R is not purely imaginary. The point is that if I took a Mass form, phi, so phi is a Mass form, and we saw in the early lectures that this corresponds to some sort of automorphic representation. Well, if this is a Hecke eigenform, it corresponds to an automorphic representation on GL2 of the Adele ring of the rationals. And the gamma factors, the infinity component of pi, is built out of well, in this case, it's not power product. Where gamma R was introduced in Jim Cogdell's lecture on Tuesday. It's the pi to the minus S over 2 gamma S over 2, which occurs in the functional equation of the Riemann zeta function. So loosely speaking, the infinity component of the higher symmetric powers L functions will be, well, more or less a product of these things, let's say like this, will be a product of these gamma factors, let's say higher symmetric power, higher m symmetric power L functions will be a product of these things up to such things up to from minus m to m. Things of that shape. And therefore, the idea is that if you were to know that the symmetric power L function, the m symmetric power L function of pi, supposing we knew that this was an entire function, it has some infinity part and some finite part. This is the completed L function. The completed L function, supposing we knew that it was an entire function, then because we know that the gamma function has poles at the negative integers, if the fact that R is not if R is purely imaginary, so the point is that if Selberg's conjecture is not satisfied, then we would be able to produce a pole of the infinity factor at some point beta, and that would, because the product is an entire function, that would force the finite part to be having a trivial zero in order to kill the pole. So So the idea is that if I don't know how to say this. So let me be a bit more precise. So more precisely, suppose that L infinity s pi looks like a product j going from 1 to m gamma r s minus mu j infinity like this, then for pi a cuspidal automorphic representation of GLN. Let's work over the rationals. It doesn't. This is not a constraint. The idea, although there are some problems if you try and work this argument over a number field. I'll come to that at the end of the lecture. But let's just concentrate on the rationals for the time being. So if I have such a cuspidal automorphic representation with this infinity component, then the generalized Selberg conjecture for GLN would be that the real part of mu j infinity is zero for all j. That's what generalized conjecture would be. And the theorem that I want to discuss today is due to Luo, Rudnick, and Sarnak, that in general, the real part of mu j infinity in absolute value is less than or equal to 1/2 minus 1 over n squared plus 1. So this is the result for general GLN, and this works. This result holds for a general number field. The improvement of this by Kim and Sarnak is that for Q, for GLN Q, you could actually make an improvement less than or equal to 1/2 minus 1 over n choose 2. Get this right. N plus 1 over 2 plus 1, which is better than that in general. But as I said, we'll discuss the argument, and there's problems with units that come up in for a general number field, which were resolved using. In that case, they were resolved using a variation of the Bombieri-Vinogradov theorem that Kumar and I had proved. so that you can get around that. So if some similar kind of improvement can be made in our work, you could actually get this for general fields. But anyway, I'll discuss that at the end. Before getting involved in technical complications, let me outline the argument in the rough so that we get some feel for what's at stake here. Perhaps before I start that, let me just point out how this is applied to get the best estimate for lambda 1 for the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. So what you do there is we will... So supposing we had this result, let me now prove that lambda 1, Selberg eigenvalue conjecture, lambda 1 is bigger than... What is the number? 0.2, 0.238. So this theorem of Kim and Sarnak will imply lambda 1 is at least 0.238, which is very close to 0.25. And the way you apply this theorem is as follows. I didn't actually write down the conditions that are needed in this result, but it is a general result, but it assumes that LS pi symmetric square L function is entire. I mean, there's some condition on this L function that has to be, you have to have it entire before you can apply this thing. So in the case under study, we will apply it, we will take pi to be, so this is for general pi on GLM, for pi, cuspid automorphic representation on GLM. So let's not get confused now with my notation. So I'm going to take pi to be the symmetric fourth power. Oops, let's say capital pi. And the twists. Dirichlet characters. Chi squareds actually, but let me just put quotation marks because I don't want to list all these conditions down now. But you apply it to the symmetric fourth power of little pi, and this is according to the functoriality conjecture proved by Henry Kim, this is an automorphic representation. This is an element of GL5. So for n equals 5, we apply the theorem for n equals 5. We can do that. So you need this, and you need all its Dirichlet twists to be entire, and those conditions are all satisfied thanks to Henry's work. So you apply this with that, and you end up getting that real part of mu j infinity corresponding to what? Capital pi, just to make sure that we don't mess up our inequalities. This is less than or equal to 1/2 minus 1 over 5. 5 plus 1 is 6. That's 30 divided by 2, that's 15, plus 1 is 16. And so that's 7 over 16. And what is this, going back to my comment here, where I say that when you take the symmetric mth power, you're basically having gamma factors of this shape. So there will be, in the symmetric fourth power, there will be four times the four times r. So that would imply that real part of r in the original Selberg eigenvalue conjecture is at most 7 over 64, 7 over 64. Because there's a fourth power here, and the 4 comes down here, and then you get that. And then when you go back and translate the you know, 1 quarter plus that thing squared, you end up getting this inequality. So this is the best result known to humanity at the moment on lambda 1. So let me outline the rather ingenious argument that goes into this thing. So let me talk a little about averages of L functions. Okay, if you give me a Dirichlet series, let's say absolutely convergent for real part s bigger than 1 for the time being, you can always write a Dirichlet series as a Mellon transform of the partial sums of this thing, and you can also have an approximation, start the series first, and then from x to infinity you can use partial summation. So I'll leave this as an exercise for you to do. Capital S of x is summation an, n less than or equal to x. So you can always write your Dirichlet series as a kind of a partial Dirichlet series, and that's some tail thing, because it's just a small elementary exercise. And if f is in a suitable class, suppose f was an entire function with a functional equation relating s to 1 minus s, you would expect some form of Lindelof hypothesis to hold for the partial sums. So now, if f is an automorphic L function, if f corresponds to an automorphic L function, you want t here, dt, t to the s plus 1, and then from x to infinity. Sorry about that. Yeah, thanks. Okay. F is an automorphic L function. Then one would expect, one expects f of s to satisfy the Lindelof hypothesis. And what is that? It's basically a statement about the growth of the function . You should expect some sort of mod t to the epsilon, some sort of conductor term. So what do I use for conductor? Q to the epsilon. Normally, in order to avoid the stupid problem of t equals 0, people just add a 2 and stick it in there, just so that you don't need to talk about that it's not 0 or something like that. So you do that. So this is what you would expect to be the generalized Lindelof hypothesis, where Q is the conductor of f of s. That is a thing that appears in the functional equation. So you would expect something like that. Now, if you had an estimate of this shape, it's a very routine exercise in contour integration that these automorphic L functions, because we know exactly what the infinity components look like, that they are gamma functions, and we expect that if the function is an entire function, we would expect that S of x is O of x to the half q to the epsilon. So this is the consequence. Of Lindelof hypothesis. For f of s. Okay. So now suppose we wanted to consider averages. So suppose that we want to study the average. So f of beta chi, and we average over certain characters chi mod q. So here's the strategy. We have this picture in our minds. We know that if the gamma function, if the real part of this thing is not zero, this thing is going to have some pole. The gamma factor is going to have some pole for real part s bigger than zero. Okay, and that would mean that it would produce a trivial zero for the finite part of the L function. So if now you took the finite parts of the L function and averaged, so it would have a trivial zero, let's say at beta, and if you now took the finite part of the L function and averaged them over these Dirichlet characters, and supposing you showed that this average was not zero, then the original hypothesis is false. Now remember I mentioned the most important point is that under certain twists, like even twists, twisting by Dirichlet characters which are even, the gamma factors don't change. So if the real part of the mu j infinity was positive, then for all the even twists, there would still be a pole introduced by the gamma factor, and there would be a trivial zero for each of those twists. So chi, let's say even. But let's not worry about this. But we may have to put some conditions on chi. Okay, I just don't want to stick it in there for the. Okay, let's. I think I did here. So let's say chi even. So we want to consider that. So what we do is, if we're trying to talk about averages of Dirichlet series, usually in practice, you approximate it by some finite thing and with some error term. That's what that expression is doing there. So if we have such an expression with f of s, you also have an expression f of s chi, summation n less than or equal to x, a n chi n of n of the s plus s from x to infinity, s of t chi dt over t to the s plus 1. And when you twist by chi, you will be changing the conductor, so this is a reasonable thing kind of to be expecting for each of these twisted partial sums. So we put that in here. So let's say summation chi even, and we approximate the thing by a finite sum and an error term for each of the ST chi's will have an error term of t to the half q to the epsilon. And if you stick that estimate into the integral and do the integration and average the whole thing over, you'll get something like q to the 1 plus epsilon x to the 1 half minus beta. So you'll get that. And now you do the obvious, you interchange summation. I just assumed that, I'm assuming that all the partial sums with twists, I'm assuming basically that st chi, when I twist by a character chi mod q, I'm assuming it's O of t to the half q to the epsilon. No, we don't know that. Yeah, I'm assuming Lindelof hypothesis because I want to illustrate the idea in its simplest form, okay? Because if I try and explain to you these two things, there will be a lot of technical clutter, which I'm going to get to. But I don't want to get to that at the very beginning, then lose everybody. The idea is extremely simple. You know, if the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture is false, the gamma factor is going to introduce a pole. The finite part of the L function must therefore introduce a zero, and this zero will be preserved by all these twists, and I take these twists and I average them over all those twists, and I show that the average is not zero. And therefore, the original thing was, that's the idea. And once you have that idea in your mind, you will put up with all sorts of technical complications. Exactly. All you need is one twist, but we don't know how to produce that one twist. Exactly. So that's where the thing, you know, it's a nice idea. Okay, so inside, so I'm summing over chi mod q. It's always like this, this poetic statement, if I know where I'm going, I have all the energy to make the trip. If you don't know where you're going, right? So here, I just want people to see where we're headed. We have something like this. Now, what is the sum inside? We have to be a bit cautious here. We actually have to make sure that my character is not the trivial character, or actually in practice it may be that we may have to avoid a finite number of characters, like this problem that we talked about very briefly at the end of last day. Exactly, yeah. But I'll show you in a moment that averaging over characters mod little q is not sufficient. You have to average over the progressions too. And this is a familiar theme in analytic number theory, that if you're getting a result using Lindelof hypothesis, chances are you can, on average, chances are you can get the same result without using Lindelof hypothesis, provided you average over enough characters. I mean, that's just the general. This is, I think, the way anybody would see this approach. The inside sum is what? Well, I'll leave it to you to check that if chi is even, you're going over even characters, then this sum is phi of q over 2 if n is congruent to plus or minus 1 mod q. And q is a prime in all of this, by the way, q prime. So 5q is q minus 1, and it's 0 otherwise. That's just because chi is even, you can think of it as a character modulo squares, and then you quotient out in the subgroup of squares. It basically, chi lives on subgroups of squares, and then you can more or less get this. So if I now put in chi even not equal to chi naught, then it's just minus 1, minus 1, okay? So we now plug this back in. So put this back in. the above expression, and what happens, we end up getting that this is equal to summation n less than x, n congruent to plus or minus 1 mod q, a n over n to the beta, times, well, remember, 5q is q minus 1. Q minus 1 over 2 minus 1, plus, or rather minus, n less than x, n congruent to, not congruent to plus or minus 1 mod q, a n over n to the beta, so on and so forth. And we get O of q to the 3 halves minus beta. Oops. Okay, so that's what we end up getting. And we're going to choose x equal to q. Why do we like to do that? Because if x equals q, I know exactly what are the numbers congruent to plus or minus 1 mod q. Okay, so choose x equals q. So that the numbers that are congruent to one mod, plus or minus 1 mod q are a1, so it gives me, so that summation chi mod q, chi even, not the trivial character, f of beta chi, turns out to be equal to q minus 1 over 2, q minus, well, minus 1, let's not worry about these small details. When n is congruent to 1, when n is congruent to minus 1, that the only way that can happen is when n equals q minus 1. Okay, so roughly n is q, so I get aq over q to the beta. Aq minus 1 over q minus 1 to the beta. Times q minus 1 over 2 minus 1. And for these guys, we just estimated using crude estimates. As I said, the Dirichlet series, remember last time I showed how sums like this can be estimated just by using the fact that it converges absolutely in a right half plane, and that comes out to be just think of an as being essentially 1, and it comes out to be q to the 1 minus beta. You can use Rank and Selberg if you want on that one. So you get that estimate for the remainder thing, and then which is completely innocuous compared to what we get here. You're going to get q to the 3 halves minus beta there. If this upsets you, just put an epsilon here if you like. Okay, but this is smaller than this, so it doesn't really matter. And here again, this is also totally irrelevant term, which is also dominated by this thing. So the final punchline is that this is equal to more or less q over 2 plus an error term of q to the 1 minus beta. Q to the 3 halves minus beta, rather. Plus an epsilon. Okay? So that's the final punchline. And now the main term is bigger than the error term, provided 3 halves minus beta is less than 1, which implies that beta has got to be bigger than a half. So this leads to real part of mu j infinity is less than or equal to, well, 1/4, and the bounds for the Satake parameters something like this. This is what you end up getting if you apply this method. So you get better results than, you know, what you got. But if you applied it for the symmetric fourth power, you'd get better results. But of course, we don't have the Lindelof hypothesis, and now we have to do a little bit of work to figure out how to get around this trouble. Okay. And for this, we apply the idea that was already explained in the Duke-Ivanovich method, where we use the functional equation to kind of give some sort of truncated version of the L functions. I actually didn't do the calculation, but I think I'll leave it as an exercise. I think you can actually improve even that using the symmetric fourth power and the symmetric square idea that you had in your paper. So, but again, it'll be conditional on the Lindelof hypothesis.
Of course, getting 1/4.
Yeah. Yeah, for GLN. Yeah, but this is what you would expect for GLN on the Lindelof. You'd get 1/4. Yeah. So, okay, so this assumed we had Lindelof. To make the argument unconditional, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I just did this calculation this morning, trying to figure out how to explain it. Yeah, I that would be a good thing to check. You know what? I have a feeling that if you use convexity, you'll get that n squared bound that I wrote down at the very beginning, 1 over n squared plus 1, you'll get something very close to that. To make the argument unconditional, we apply the approximate functional equation technique. No, it's weaker. No, it's weaker. Yeah. The Riemann hypothesis implies Lindelof, but not conversely.
Riemann hypothesis implies what?
The Riemann hypothesis implies the growth is T to the epsilon.
T to the epsilon.
Yeah.
Is it the same? T to the epsilon?
It's not the same as the Riemann hypothesis, though. Epsilon is arbitrarily positive, right? Yeah. Riemann hypothesis.
Riemann doesn't get better than,
If you assume Riemann, okay, if you assume Riemann hypothesis, the epsilons are cleaned up. But you're not going to do any better by this approach. Yeah, the growth is exponential log t over log t or something like that, if you want to get rid of the t of the epsilon.
It grows
very slowly, slower than any power of t. Yeah, if you assume the Riemann hypothesis, you can do a little bit better, but not that much better. Yeah, okay. So we'll apply the approximate functional equation technique as illustrated in the Duke-Ivanovich method.
So that growth boundary is very unrealistic for proving
at this moment. Yeah, yeah.
Very hard.
Yeah, no, but you see, this is what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to...
just trying to show you how the method works.
I mean, this is the kind of thinking that I think most people do, but never tell you that they do.
And you're paying for having told.
Okay, I mean, this is what people normally do. Your bag of tricks involves various. I mean, what's the use of a conjecture? The conjecture. I'm giving our tricks away, but basically, to figure out what the shape of the what you expect, what's reasonable to expect. Okay. All right, so last time I outlined this thing, so I'll do this very, very quickly and briefly. Let F be a function with compact support and a C infinity function with integral 0 to infinity f of x dx equal to 1, and set K of S to be 0 to infinity f of y ds dy over y. Okay. So then K of S is an entire function rapidly decreasing, and K of 0 is 1 the way we set it up. I mean, normally in the classical treatises on zeta function, it's like Titch Marsh and various other books, you will see that the approximate functional equation is given as a relationship between summation 1 over n to the s and summation 1 over n to the 1 minus s. But as far as I'm aware, the first person who brought the fact that you should put test functions is Henrik, I think. Henrik Ivanovich, would that be appropriate? Or does it go back to Voronoi or some sort of variation? Yeah, of putting test functions in and applying the technique with that. So this is what we're going to do now. So so we have K of S entire, rapidly decreasing, and K of 0 equal to 1. So for X positive, we set f1 of x to be 0. These look like boring definitions, but in a moment you'll see that they're well thought out. So remember, this notation means I'm integrating on 2 minus I infinity to 2 plus I infinity. So this is K minus S, G of minus S plus beta, x to the minus S, ds over S, where where, what is G of S? G of S is equal to L1 minus S pi infinity plus pi infinity bar over LS pi infinity plus pi infinity tilde, and LS pi tensor chi, this is the Dirichlet character, and I twist that with Rankine-Seldberg with pi tilde, this functional equation, the completed L function is equal to some gamma factors just the functional equation of the Rankine-Seldberg L function of these two things. Okay? So this, the gamma factors that appear in here, I will use those gamma factors and stick it into this integral and define f2 of x this way. Why do we want to do that? Well, it's because if you want to look at weighted sums instead of just straight sums, if I weighted with a function then with the So this is the step that I wanted to explain, this word, consider, and you can now see, consider the integral and we are integrating from 2 minus I infinity to 2 plus I infinity. In that range, this Dirichlet series converges absolutely, so you stick in the Dirichlet series and you interchange sum and, so this is 1 over 2 pi I sum and integral around. Thank you, yeah. So this is the finite part of the L function, exactly. So this is the, right. And I'm using. The infinite, the completed L function. Okay, yeah. Well, it's good. You're right. You're right. Yeah. And also, I dropped some other notation here. This should be really pi tensor chi. So I'll drop all these things and just put chi down, okay? And this is not to clutter up too much notation.
So pi can live where?
Pi is in GLN. Yeah. So in general, yeah. So we get that. So what do we have here? We have, so let's write this Dirichlet series. Yeah, you're right. I did mix in. Yeah, you're right. So this should have been if you want, I mean, change it back. Thanks. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, sorry, this is fine, yeah, this is okay, thank you. Yeah, this is okay, yeah. The completed, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's write our Dirichlet series as so I'm still continuing the same, you know, finite parts. Okay, so these are it. So if I have that, then I have B of n over n to the s plus beta pi of n, y to the s ds over s. So, everybody okay with that? And then, as I indicated, you interchange sum and integral around. And that motivates now the definition of this transform. If you get that, something like that. And that's, by my definition here, it's F1 of n over y. Okay? So this is equal to summation 1 to infinity b of n over n to the beta chi of m f1 of n over y. By the way, I want everybody to understand that this is the kind of trick of truncation. You know, if you think of a function which is 1 up to some point and 0 otherwise, suppose f1 was such a function like that, this would, let's say, if n over y is less than or equal to 1, it's 1. And zero otherwise, that'll be like a truncation operator. But this is a more smoothing operator, and in estimates, it's much better to work with such things than to cut things off. Okay. And also to allow yourself the freedom of having arbitrary functions because different transforms appear. And the nice thing about this method is that it's not necessary to actually evaluate these integrals. It's enough to estimate them. That's the beauty of the method. Okay. And I think probably the classical number theorists were thwarted in their progress to some extent because they were always trying to evaluate these transforms explicitly, and you can't always do that. Okay. Now, when you plug this back, so you get this. On the other hand, you have the vertical line integral right at the top, and we had the hypothesis that it was an entire function, and because it behaves smoothly and it's rapid decay and all these conditions hold, you can truncate the contour. So you have a vertical line integral like this. You could truncate it at some big T, come back, so this some minus T to capital T, and then you can go back to any point you want. In this case, we will take, we will go back to real part s equals minus 1. Take the limit as T goes to infinity, and the horizontal integrals can be shown to be 0 by using Stirling's formula. Okay, so that's where the precise knowledge of the gamma functions comes in. And then the integral turns out to be just simply the integral over minus 1. But of course, we have to be careful and see that what are the singularities in the region. Well, the integrand is entire. The L function is entire. The only pole comes from when s equals 0. When s equals 0, the residue is k of 0, L of beta, exactly what you want. K of 0 is 1. It pulls out exactly what you want. And remember, I'm writing this thing for pi tensor pi tilde tensor chi, okay? So this is really pi tilde tensor chi plus the integral on the line minus 1 okay. Look at that. Now we apply the functional equation on the L function. Relating it to 1 minus s minus beta. And then what happens when you apply the functional equation, this Ls chi is really equal to this epsilon factor g of s times L1 minus s chi. I think there should have been a chi bar somewhere. These things, there should have been a chi bar here, I think. Chi bar. Yeah, chi bar. It should have been chi bar there. Okay, sorry about that. But anyway, the point is that you end up getting this epsilon factor, the bunch of gamma functions, and this thing. You stick that back in there, you end up getting, so this becomes equal to L beta chi plus 1 over 2 pi I integral minus 1, some k of s, some this should be a conductor term, f of pi tensor pi bar conductor term, some character chi evaluated at the conductor quantity, Gauss sum to the power n squared, f q to the n squared to the power minus s minus beta, g of s plus beta, L1 minus s minus beta, chi bar in my notation, y to the s ds over s. So all I've done is applied the functional equation. Now change variables, change s to minus s, change variables. S goes to minus s. Okay, change that, and then so that will throw this line integral from minus 1 to 1. Okay? And because beta is positive, this Dirichlet series will be absolutely, it's in the right half plane of absolute convergence. So stick the Dirichlet series back in. Now we are in the half plane of absolute convergence for the Dirichlet series. For LS chi. So we put the Dirichlet series back in, integrate term by term, and that now explains these definitions of these F2 of X's, and you pull out F2 on the other side. So you see, on one hand, you have L beta chi, which is what you're after, and you've approximated it, you've kind of had this term as one factor, that L beta chi is more or less this. So this is like the truncated part. And this part that I'm going to do now is that part that I didn't, you know, I put in as an integral before. It comes out as, and it's really a transform. I just didn't do it. So
you're changing S to 1 minus S.
No, I'm changing S to minus S here. Yeah. That's changing S to minus S gives me 1 minus beta plus S. And then because S would be on the line real part S equals 1 now, 1 plus 1 would give me, it'll be 2 minus, so this thing will be between 1 and 2. I'm assuming that 0 is less than real part of beta, it's less than 1. So it'll be okay. Yeah, it's not, it would, I mean, I've applied the functional equation and just changing S to minus S. That's all. So that this vertical line just goes into the other vertical line. Okay. And so we end up getting, we end up with that L beta chi equals summation bn over n to the beta chi of n f1 of n over y minus some sort of conductor term pi cross pi tilde, which is always the same, chi of f, some Gauss sum to the power m squared, some conductor term again, q to the m squared minus beta, so summation n going from 1 to infinity b of n chi bar of n over n to the 1 minus beta f2 of y over y over f q to the m squared m. Yeah, you now know why. Sorry about that. So okay, should I just put? Sorry about that. This is m is now n. was GLM instead of GLM, GLR or whatever. Sorry about that. Yeah, now I see why certain notations are used in the paper. Is that okay? I hope I haven't confused people. Anyone confused? Okay. Because of this technicality, let me emphasize the idea again. L beta chi is what we're after. We want to average this. So we try and write it as some sort of truncated thing. This is like, you should think of this as some sort of truncated approximation. You would approximate L beta chi by something like this. You would actually take it from 1 to infinity, but this is some sort of truncation operator, and the error that you're creating is really kind of concealed in this. But now we have an explicit, so this is really called the approximate functional equation. Because you see, it's relating the beta and the 1 minus beta here. So this is called the approximate functional equation. Should I change the m to n and put u to 1 to infinity or something, b of u?
No, that's
this is n.
Oh, that's an n.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, that's an n.
That's an n.
Oh, but now I didn't
have to
ask which
n. Yeah. Is everyone okay? Everyone at the back okay? No. Yeah, that's the idea. These are all rapid decay functions, and therefore everything is okay in terms of convergence. Now what we do, you see, we average over chi. Chi even, and not equal to chi zero. And now what happens? Okay, we happily average on the left-hand side. We average on the right, this one. The analysis of this is exactly as before. You pull the summation over chi's inside. You use the orthogonality relation, which I probably rubbed out by now, and analyze this term exactly as we did before. Okay? Now here, though, when you average over the chi's, remember two lectures ago I told you that if you take Gauss sums and raise them to some fixed power and average over the chi's, it's really a hyperclustermann sum. And for a hyperclustermann sum, we have Dillon's bound, which, as a consequence of the Weyl conjectures, which allows us to estimate that. So that's the key point. Question? Correct. Okay, so skipping some details. Well, you know, once you get the idea, it's not hard to, you would put up with the details. I mean, you could, now it's easier to read the paper. Okay, so we average over chi, the first term is handled as before. The second term involves averaging twisted powers of twisted averaging powers of twisted Gauss sums, powers of twisted Gauss sums, or twisted whatever. Anyway, it's hard to figure out where the adjective goes. Okay, which involves averaging of these powers of Gauss sums. Forget this. You know, this, remember I told you that if you stick in a character, you're still going to get hyperclustralism, and this gives rise. So which gives rise to hyperclustralman sums, which are in turn estimated, and these are estimated using Dillon's bound. So quite a hefty amount of algebraic geometry goes into that one. And the final result is what? No. You bring in summation chi here, okay, and you bring it through here, and so those are twisted. So when I so you'll end up getting chi bar of n, chi of f, tau of chi to the m squared. This is estimated. So it's a summation over chi, and this is estimated like let's say q to the half or something, okay. And then now we use the fact that we're in the Rankine-Selberg case and the B of n's are non-negative. So when you put absolute values, it's actually B of n still. Okay, and so so you basically you're only going to put mod F2 there. But it's really not an essential point, and this is the point that's made in your, you know, your last journal of the AMS paper. It is not really essential to have positivity of the B of n's. And that's why you could apply it to the symmetric square L function. What you do is you put absolute values on the F2 and then just estimate it brutally. So what is it? This is a rapid decay. What does rapid decay mean? F2 of x is less than x to the minus n for any n. Okay, so you just stick it in here in that silly sort of way, and then and the final result is I think it's safe to skip a few pages. The details will be provided in the notes. Final result is I have to tell you one more point. Okay, you do this, but now you have to actually average this over Q's. So using Dillon's bound, and we have to do one more averaging over the Q's, the progressions, the modulus rather. So let me explain that. We averaged over chi's first, and now we're going to average over Q. Yeah. So we Okay, so we treat that term brutally. I mean, just in the, after applying Dillon's bound, you really don't do anything more further with that. So that's more or less completely under control as far as this analysis is concerned. I just want to now focus on the first term. On the first term, you still have a little bit of leeway, which I want to see. Remember, before I chose x equals q, and so when I said that the summation part that survives is n congruent to plus or minus 1 modulo q, and I said by choosing x equals q, there weren't that many numbers that were congruent to 1 plus or minus 1 modulo q. So that allowed me to pick out the main term being coming from n equals 1, and everything else kind of coming out to be error. Now here, because y is going to be chosen big, so let's do the analysis of the first term a little carefully. Okay, we average this expression over q lying in an interval. Q lies in an interval of the form q to 2q. Okay, so we average this over that. So let's do that. And again, we use the fact that zero has many divisors, and a non-zero number doesn't have very many divisors. We use that fact, okay? So when we average, so let's average, so when I did the averaging of chi mod q, I told you how to estimate the second part. The first part, it comes out, so we get summation q in q, chi mod q, chi even, L beta chi, comes out to be summation n, b of n, n of the beta, summation chi, I think I should better keep this outside. Keep this outside. So remember I told you that essentially what survives here is plus or minus 1 mod q. And then you pick up more or less q minus 1 over 2. Okay, more or less. Plus error. All right, so now we pull out the n equals 1 term. Okay, so that gives you b1 over 1, which is 1. And I'm summing over q's, and I'm going to come up with how many q's am I summing over? Well, remember, little q's a prime. Number of primes in the interval q to 2q is something like q over log q again. So and each one is of the size q. So I'm going to pick up some constant q squared over log q as the main term. And then now I'm going to sum over q in this range, n congruent to plus or minus 1 mod q, n not equal to 1, b of n over n to the beta, q minus 1 over 2, plus dot dot dot. And now we interchange summation here. What do we have? We have a summation over n, b of n over n to the beta. Each of these things is non-negative, so this is at most q. And inside, we have, so this is an estimate I'm doing, b of n's are non-negative, remember. And so inside, what do I have? I have q twiddles capital Q, and little q divides n plus or minus 1. 1. There. Pardon me? What's this term? I'm just working on this one term, exactly. This whole expression here. And I'm now going to use the fact that this is not zero. since n plus or minus 1 is not 0, it's a natural number, and the number of primes that can possibly divide a natural number is at most log of that number. Okay, so and being foolish, just put n to the epsilon here, throw it out, and you end up getting b of n over n to the beta, n to the epsilon, and going from 1 to infinity. And remember, b of n is by Rankine-Selberg on average like 1. So just think of this as 1 over n to the beta, and this, sorry, I should have, I forgot this f1. F1 of n over y. Okay, there's an f1 of n over y in there somewhere. Everyone with me? So I'm analyzing the first term, okay? So we end up getting that this whole thing is bounded by q times y to the 1 minus beta plus epsilon. That's what you end up getting. That's right. So, exactly. Yeah. That's right. I'm gonna choose y now. So y is an arbitrary thing. It's like the parameter that I should have introduced. Yeah. So y is arbitrary, and I haven't told you what y is yet. But we will choose y optimally. And there's no further trick on the second part. The second part, as I said, beyond this clever idea of using Dillon's estimate for hyperclustrum and sums, there's nothing new. You just...
Once you've done that, you can't average over Q as well.
Yeah, you can't. So if you had some sort of higher dimensional version of Selberg-Linick or something like that for hyperclustrum and sums, then maybe you can get somewhere. But besides that, you can't do anything. So you do estimate that brutally, and the standard method of estimating the second part leads to a final estimate. Yeah?
What happened to that little first part? Was that little first part? Did you square root of the log? Did that like in a little
y? F1, 1 over y. Remember, f1 of 1, 0 is 1. That's right. You're absolutely right. There's an f1, 1 over y. But I've estimated f1 of 1 over y to be 1 plus y to the minus something. You know, so it's really small. It's more or less 1 for all intents and purposes. Okay? Yeah, that's a good question. Sorry about that. It does play a role. And then now, putting everything together, and choosing. See, we have two error terms. So you have a main term, constant q squared over log q. You have an error term here that you're going to get. And you have another error term that I'm not going to write down from the other part. And the way to choose the y is to equate the two error terms. And then choosing y appropriately to minimize the error term allows us to deduce that the first term dominates the error if beta is bigger than 1/2 minus 1 over n squared plus 1. This is the result that I was, the Luo-Rudnick-Sarnak result that I was talking about. Okay, now in the 3 minutes remaining, let me point out that we really... Yeah.
What did you really use of this L function besides occasionally you used it for an equation, but if you ever use it, it's really the form pi times pi tilde.
Only in the positivity of the coefficients in this argument.
And what kind of convergence?
Convergence to the real part that's bigger than one. Yeah.
But otherwise, you didn't use any point that it's really pi tilde.
Well, I did in the sense that that allowed me to tell what the epsilon factors were, the functional equation. I need the functional equation very precisely, because otherwise, I think I'd be stuck on the second part here. See, I used that information about the fact that pi infinity was spherical. I mean, that's the technical way of saying that you know exactly how the infinity component is behaving to tell me what this guy looks like. Okay, I need to know that. But as you know, I did not really use the positivity of the coefficients. If you check this argument very carefully, all I did was it looked like I used it, but it really didn't use it. And that's the observation that's made in the paper with Kim and Sarnak. So they apply this, instead of applying it to pi tensor pi tilde, like I did, so Kim and Sarnak apply the argument to, well, LS symmetric fourth power of little pi, which we know is an L function on GL5, and then we can take the symmetric square of that L function. So given an automorphic representation, we know that the symmetric square L function has the right properties, you see. This is a theorem of Shahidi, I think, isn't it? Or is it yours? That if you have pi, the symmetric square L function is also, for general GLN, is also entire under suitable constraint. Yeah. As long as pi tilde is not self-contrigredient or something, then you have a result that says that the symmetric square L function is actually entire. So this is an extra added fact. Given an automorphic symmetric square L function is also entire, so you have this extra information. So instead of applying it to symmetric 4 pi tensor symmetric 4 pi, they apply it to this one. And there's no positivity in that's really needed, and you still work out the epsilon factors appropriately, and the averaging goes through. And that's what leads to the better result, that beta bigger than 1/2 minus 1 over n plus 1 over 2 plus 1. I think this is what comes down to. And that finally gives us... You could do that, yeah. You could. I don't think anyone's done it, but one could, yeah. Yeah, so this concludes the method of estimating Fourier coefficients of cusp forms. Now, this, I did it for the eigenvalue thing, but the same method actually can work for the Fourier, the Sataka parameters, the alpha p's. So the same method will work, and then you end up getting the same result, and therefore it puts, as I explained kind of metaphorically, the eigenvalue, Selberg eigenvalue conjecture and the Ramanujan conjecture are analogous, so you get, and they get the same results. So you end up getting these improvements. So hopefully now you'll be able to understand the notes better than, because I've given this rationale for doing all these constructions. Next week, my idea is to trying to explain the Langlands tunnel theorem, and how the symmetric power L functions are used to proving that. Okay, so I'll give a little brief introduction to Artin L functions first, and then try and work toward that. Okay.